Prequels and origin stories are pretty popular today, whether it's the origins of some superhero or villain or just a prequel to an epic series. People like to explain how things happen, how they came about, where things came from. Sometimes they do that because there's obviously a story there. You know, what in the world is Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader talking about in that first Star Wars movie when they're going back and forth? Or where's the Wicked Witch of the West? Where's she come from? Some of the stories, they just want to give you a fuller background to this world that the author's made. And that's what you see in C.S. Lewis's Magician's Nephew. But then other origin stories today, they basically rewrite history. And Disney's been doing that a lot lately with some of their origin stories for villains like Maleficent and Cruella de Vil. And somehow they managed to basically absolve these villains of all their evil. I mean, which is a pretty big feat because those names, Maleficent means causing harm and destruction. And Cruella de Vil is just basically a tweak on cruel devil. So it's fascinating that they can do that. But when it comes to the book of Genesis, we also have this origin story. It's not this fictional origin story. It's the origin story. Actually, that's what the Greek word Genesis means. It has to do with an account of an origin of something or someone. Now, what does the origin story of Genesis talk about? What does it explain? What account does it give? It's not the origin of God, even though God is the main character. Instead, it's the origin of God's relationship with his people. Now, why is that important for us to know? Well, Peter, that we just finished his letter, he was very clear that God's story of the old covenant people is fulfilled in the new covenant people. The very same people that we have been grafted into by his electing grace and by means of our faith. So Genesis is our story. It's our origin story. Now, why would that matter? Because it explains the context for how we view our world. See, the narratives in the Bible, the stories in the Bible, they're not just fictional stories that tell a moral. These are true stories, the true story that God is writing. He's telling us the way things really are. And so they establish a worldview, a way of looking at the world. Now, what we do today, very often, what people do with the Bible is they take the worldview that the society teaches us and we apply it to the Bible. Instead, what we're supposed to do is read the worldview that Scripture tells us about and apply that to our world. That's the way we're supposed to view the world. That's what these narratives are doing. That's why it's important for us to look at Genesis, and that's what we're coming back to. We've been in Genesis, and we just keep taking these breaks, and now we're going to finish it out. So Genesis, the story of our relationship with God, the origin of our relationship with God, it begins with this account of creation, and that's an account, despite maybe what some people have told you, that is very different from the worldview of the people in Moses' day. See, the people in that time, they believed that the gods were a part of the universe, that they were bound by its rules. And yet, what you read in Genesis at the beginning is that there's no chaotic forces that God has to subdue. There are no rivals to his power and authority. God simply speaks, and creation comes to be. And when he first made everything, it functioned the way that he intended it to. It was good. Even humanity. God created us in his image to represent and imitate his rule over the earth. And when God blessed mankind at the very beginning, he revealed his plan. His plan to fill the earth with image bearers who reflect his holy character and give him glory, the glory that he deserves. And to do that all over the planet, that was his plan. So Genesis, and you can turn there, we're going to be in chapter 36, but Genesis is broken down, or it's broken into sections. They're all headed by these titles that read the generations of so-and-so. These are the generations of so-and-so. So you have the generations of Adam, or of Noah, or the generations of Terah, and so on. Now, instead of looking at the word generations, let's just think of the word generate. Helps us understand what Moses is getting at here. The word generate means to produce something. And these titles are describing what these people produce. We could translate them. Here's what came from this person. And so the focus of this story isn't really the person in the title, but the person who came from him. So, very beginning, we have a title starting in chapter 2. And in these different sections, God's promise of blessing through his communion with him, God tells that story about his promise. And he also tells the story of his providence in bringing about that communion with him. And so in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, we see that those promises established. And then in all the chapters that follow, we see God's providence as he works out his promise to have communion with God, to bless us with that communion with him. So after Genesis creation account, it says in Genesis 2:4, these are the generations of the heavens and the earth. So we could translate that. This is what came from the heavens and the earth. Now, first, that might not seem to work because you're expecting a person. But the first man came from the earth, came from the ground. And then the first woman came from him. So after creating them, God placed them in this garden where all their needs were met. And he gave them this priestly task of taking care of the sacred place where he would dwell with them. And then he provided them with the means to worship and enjoy him forever. He just gave them one command. And that command gave them the opportunity to show that they loved God more than they loved themselves. And God promised that their obedience would bring life and that their disobedience would bring death. Now, I'm sure you remember what happened in Genesis chapters 2 and really a 3 and onward. The satanic serpent comes and he twists God's word. And he tells them, hey, you guys need to be like God by determining what's right and wrong for yourselves. And instead of trusting in God, instead of demonstrating their love for God above all things, the woman believed the serpent's word against God's word and she disobeyed. And the man rebelliously followed. So God punished them. But he also gave a promise, even in that punishment. He promised that the woman's offspring, from the woman's offspring, would come this one who would deal with the serpent and deal with his evil. In the meantime, though, these first two humans, they are banished from perpetual life with God. And yet God didn't abandon them. But the situation doesn't get immediately better. The firstborn son, Cain, murdered his brother Abel. And God punished Cain, but he graciously keeps him alive. He preserves his life. And though Cain's descendants, they show this amazing capacity for innovation and invention, they still follow in the direction of Cain. And so what you have at the climax of that first genealogy is Lamech, who boasts about murder. And then God gave Adam and Eve another son, Seth. And Seth points us to our hope for humanity. With Seth's line, you hear about communion with God. It was at that time that there's this distinction between those that have communion with God and those that do not. And then at Genesis 5:1, we hear about the generations of Adam. So what came from Adam? When you read chapter 5, it's not only people that came from Adam, but death came from Adam. Adam's descendants are listed out, melodically listed out in a dirge where every single instance ends with God's punishment. And he died. Everyone except Enoch. This random person there, Enoch. And God rescues Enoch from death to give us hope. And what's that hope based on? Well, it's the one thing that sets Enoch apart from everyone else, communion with God. He walked with God. Now, even though we see God's curse of death, what we also see, even starting at the beginning of chapter 6, is blessing, God's blessing. Because humanity is fruitful and multiplied. But what's equally clear in chapter 6 is that humanity is depraved. So speaking of humanity, Genesis 6:5 says, every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And so what God's justice called for was to wipe the earth clean of this mess of humanity and that they'd made. But he showed grace to Noah. So Genesis 6:9 says, the generations of Noah. And there's hope immediately at the beginning of that because Noah has communion with God. So God told Noah what he he must do if he's going to preserve his life, his family's life, animal life. He told him what he needed to do, and Noah obeyed. And then this same God who created the whole earth to be ruled by humanity, he then judged the entire earth for their sin. He decreated the earth in those chapters, bringing it back to this lifeless, formless deep that's mentioned in Genesis 1-2. And it was lifeless except for those who were on the ark. And then in a deliberate reversal of the flood, God recreates the earth. And after the flood, he reestablished his relationship with humanity. Noah makes sacrifices to God, and God blesses Noah and his sons. But this fresh start did not put an end to that depravity. You see it immediately. God announces it in chapter 8, and then you see Noah get shamelessly drunk. And then you see Ham, his son, dishonor him. But God still blesses his people. He still blesses humanity. And you hear about that in the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Every nation that Israel knew about was traced back to these three branches of Noah's family. But then this family begins to grow, and they grow so big that they realize we're going to have to separate, and they don't want to do that. And so they invent something, a city. And that in and of itself isn't a problem. It would allow them to stick together. At the end of our Bibles, we end up in a city. But instead of seeking communion with God the way that he intended, they invent something else. They invent their own way to reach God's blessing for themselves. And so because of that united rebellion, God split them up by confusing their language. So Genesis 11:10 then begins with this genealogy titled The Generations of Shem. Genealogies in Genesis, as we're going to see, they mark turning points in the story. So there was a genealogy in chapter 5 that marked a turning point with Noah, where there is this new humanity after this flood. But that humanity did not enjoy communion with God. They turned away from that. And so the genealogy in chapter 11, it marks off this new turning point where God is going to bring about, he's going to begin to bring about at that point a people who will enjoy communion with him. And so with Abram, who's the focus of the genealogy in chapter 11, there's this beginning of God's providence in bringing about that new humanity. And that's what we see from then on. And so in Genesis 11:27, it says, now these are the generations of Terah. And then there's a longer story about the one who came from Terah, Abram. Now, the choice of Abram is really strange. When you think about what God did there, because he chose a pagan idol worshiper to start this new humanity who's going to enjoy communion with him. That's who Abram is. He's not looking for God. He doesn't know God. And yet God chooses him. And he brings about, through Abram, this group of holy worshipers. But again, he begins with Abram, and he begins with a barren couple. Everybody around them is blessed. They're fruitful and multiplying. And God begins with this couple who's cursed, and he promises to bless them in a new way. And he gives Abram a command along with his promise. He told him to leave his homeland and to travel to another land where he would bless him. And Abraham responds with faith. And we know that because he obeyed. He left. He went to the promised land. But Abram does not know this God very well. And so we get to know God through Abraham's experience of getting to know God. Abram, the first time he sees trouble, what does he do? He relies on himself. This is the constant problem that Adam and Eve began with and that humans continue to do. He relies on himself. He goes to Egypt in order to escape a famine. But he lies about his beautiful wife, calls her his sister because he's afraid the Egyptians are going to kill him in order to get her. And he creates this big mess. But despite that mess, the Lord providentially rescued him and his wife. So what Abram doesn't realize, what he doesn't know, is what we see throughout the book of Genesis. That God's promises, his plans, they cannot be thwarted. There is nothing you can do to stop God's plans. Time after time in this book, there are obstacles to God's promises that come up. And every time, God overcomes them. See, when God created the universe, sometimes we think about him creating it and then just kind of stepping back and only intervening at points. That's not true. God continued to rule over his universe. He didn't do that as a puppet master. He didn't do that by creating creatures who robotically are programmed to do exactly what he wants. His rule is a little bit more mysterious than that. God, he does govern every aspect of the universe, every aspect of the story of the universe. But he does it mysteriously. He's able to do it through the moral, responsible, free choices. And I say morally responsible is what I mean. Morally responsible, free choices of people, of humans. So no matter how big of a mess we're responsible for making, and no matter how big the obstacle may seem, God keeps his promises. He carries out his plan through this mysterious providence. So in the life of Abram, God takes care of the obstacle of Abram's nephew, Lot. See, Lot and his descendants, they could have made a claim on the promised land, and yet God removed him from the situation. But he didn't do that by making Lot make this decision he didn't really want to make. Lot makes his own free and foolish decision to align himself with Sodom. And that's the way that God removes him and his descendants, the Ammonites and Moabites, removes them from the promised land. It's completely Lot's choice, and yet it is entirely according to God's providence. At the beginning of chapter 15, though, Abram does not have an heir still. He's had this promise from God, and he doesn't understand it. And so God's response is to promise him again, so that he would have descendants. In fact, more than you can count even the stars. And Abram believed God. And what that text says is that God considered Abram righteous on the basis of his faith. And that's the same basis that our right relationship is based on, faith. So God makes this special promise with Abram through a covenant. And that covenant agreement is, it binds Abraham to God. And yet here's the problem. This communion that it establishes is with a holy God. So how can God bind himself, being the holy God he is, to people who are not holy? And during this process of making this covenant, the Lord demonstrates through the ritual that he is going to take the responsibility for this covenant to be kept. That he is going to be the one to pay the penalty when his covenant partners break the covenant. So he promised to absorb the death penalty as he walks between these animals that are cut in two. Now that doesn't make sense at the time. How's God going to do that? But from the foot of the cross, we do understand how God did it. In Jesus, God took the curse of the covenant so that his people would enjoy the blessings that he had promised through that covenant. Abram and Sarai, though, they still don't understand how God can keep this promise. And so they do, again, what humans do. They relied on themselves. And Sarai suggested that Abram take her slave Hagar to be his concubine, to be a surrogate mother for their child. That's a practice that was totally acceptable in Abram's day, but it was totally unacceptable to God. And it didn't turn out at all the way they thought it was going to. They made a huge mess. And yet, God still graciously intervenes. He provided for Hagar. He provided for Ishmael. He even promised Ishmael that he'd bless him. Then in Genesis 17, God changes Abram's name to Abraham, which means father of many. And he reiterated his promises again to Abraham. But he also gave this requirement of circumcision. Now, circumcision is this outward change that pointed to the inward change that was necessary for this people to walk blamelessly before God, which is what God says at the beginning of chapter 17. God also changed Sarai's name to Sarah to make it perfectly clear, hey, the son of promise is going to come through her. Now, Abraham's response, you remember what his response was to that? He laughed. He thought it was ridiculous because Sarah, she's beyond childbearing years. And yet God, and so actually at that point, Abraham offers Ishmael, saying, God, Ishmael is a more reasonable way for you to keep your promise. And God says, no, The child of promise is going to come through Sarah. And guess what you get to name her? You get to name him Isaac, which means he laughs. So Abraham's laughter is commemorated in that. But even though Abraham responds with laughter, he also believed God. He obeys. He circumcises himself and his entire household. And then the Lord appears just a little later, and he tells the same promise, and Sarah overhears, and she laughs. And again, the Lord reiterates to them. He assures them that nothing can stop his promises. At that point, the story turns to Lot. Lot's still around. He hasn't been really dealt with completely. And at that point, the judge of all the earth, as Abraham puts it, he demonstrates his justice. He shows that he is sovereignly ruling over everything by punishing Sodom and Gomorrah. And even though Lot and his family, they're reluctant to even leave this place, God forcefully and graciously rescues them. Sin had thoroughly impacted Lot and his family. But they weren't the only sinners in the story, because as soon as the camera pans back to Abraham, we find Abraham doing the same thing that he did earlier. He's lying his way out of a jam. He's trying to preserve his life by actually putting his wife's purity in jeopardy. This time it's with Abimelech. And once again, God overcomes that obstacle. And then right after that, God miraculously gave Abraham and Sarah that promised son. And then God preserves the covenant promises for Isaac alone. But he does that again providentially through Sarah's scheming. Sarah's not right. And yet God tells Abraham, listen to Sarah, send Hagar away. And he still takes care of them, but removes them from the promised land. So just as Abraham receives God's promised son, God tests him. He tells him that he had to sacrifice that son. So Abraham has to decide to whom he's going to be more devoted, to the son that God promised or to the one who promised him. And it's amazing because Abraham staggeringly obeys. And so with his knife raised in the air, the Lord announces that he's passed the test, and he stops him. And then the Lord provides a ram to take the place of Isaac. And what he does in that moment is he points to the day that he is going to do what he didn't have Abraham do. The day that he is going to give his son, his only son, the son whom he loved, to be the sacrifice in the place of sinners like us. And it's at this zenith in Abraham's faith that Abraham just fades from the story. But what we see even there at the conclusion is that Abraham resolutely believes in these promises. He believed that his descendants would have this land. And so when Sarah dies, he buys a burial place for her. When Isaac needs a wife, he goes outside of Canaan because he recognizes his descendants are going to have this land, and there cannot be a confusion between the Canaanites and his people. And even when he gets remarried with Keturah, he does not give her the full status of wife. What's he doing there? He's preserving the inheritance of this blessing for Isaac alone. He sends the other sons outside of the promised land. And then at the end of that, God keeps his promise of Genesis 15:15. And Abraham died in a good old age, it says. In Genesis 25:11, God passed these covenant promises on to Isaac. But before he turns to Isaac, he turns to the son who doesn't receive the covenant promises, the son who wasn't chosen. Genesis 25:12 reads the generations of Ishmael. And there's this short genealogy that shows that God kept his promises to Ishmael. Promises to multiply his offspring. Promises to give him 12 princes and to make him a great nation. Now, with that transitional genealogy, then Moses turns back to the main storyline. He turns back to the next major section in Genesis 25. And in verse 19, it says, these are the generations of Isaac. And at the very beginning, there's these two boys. But it becomes very clear which one of the ones that comes from Isaac, that Isaac produced, we're going to focus on. We're going to focus on the younger son. God promises through this oracle that it's going to be the younger son who is stronger, who rules over the older. But as we're introduced to this covenant member, he is a wily, self-reliant, person who takes advantage of his brother at his most vulnerable point, and he trades him a bowl of soup for his birthright. Now, the next scene seems out of place because Jacob, who is the central figure here, he's not there. But it's also very familiar because what we see is Isaac taking a page out of his father's book and lying his way out of trouble, and at the same time putting his wife at jeopardy. So even in that chapter, even in a chapter that really is looking a lot like Abraham, God promises Isaac that he's committed to him because Abraham obeyed when he was tested. Now, we know this is still all according to God's plan, and yet what Abraham's obedience providentially does is it points to the way that we are blessed. Isaac is blessed through the obedience of Abraham. We are blessed through the obedience of the Messiah. That is how we receive that blessing. Now, it's at that point that we come to the major conflict in this story with Jacob. Isaac, he tries to reserve the blessing for his favorite son. His wife, Rebekah, overhears, and she makes a plan, plots to reserve that for her favorite son. So Jacob listens to his mom, and he takes advantage of his blind father. And he's successful. He gets the blessing. And he also has to leave town because his brother is enraged against him. He's going to kill him. Now, God didn't approve of what they were doing and their choices they were making. And yet, his plans providentially move forward without hindrance. Nothing that they sinfully did jeopardized what God was doing. So Isaac recognizes that God is passing on these covenant blessings to Jacob, and he wants to protect Jacob from the foolish and covenant-denying decision that Esau made in marrying Canaanite women, and he sends Jacob away. And as Jacob leaves the promised land, he has this encounter with God at a place that he names Bethel. Now, Jacob shows no evidence of sorrow for his sin. He's not repentant in the slightest. But God still appears to him and promises him the very same promises that he made to his father Isaac and to his grandfather Abraham. Of course, Jacob, being the untrustworthy person he is, does not trust God any more than he trusts himself. And so he tries to bind God to his promises, and he makes this vow. God, he's trying to ensure that God will keep his word. And then right after that, God providentially arranges for Jacob to find exactly who he's looking for, just like God did with Abraham's servant when he was looking for Isaac's wife. So Jacob finds his relative Laban, who welcomes him in and offers him work. And Jacob takes advantage of the opportunity and asks to work for Laban for 7 years in exchange for his daughter's hand in marriage, Rachel's. So when the 7 years are up, Jacob gets a taste of his own medicine. This time, though, instead of sneaking the younger for the older, Jacob experiences the reverse. Laban sneaks his older daughter, Leah, in for his younger daughter, Rachel. And it takes another seven-year deal in order for Jacob to get the daughter that he loved. Now, even though Laban is absolutely wrong in the way that he did this, this, again, is no less than God's providence. See, God is at work, even in Laban's evil intentions, in order to ensure his plan to bring a king from Leah's line. That king that one day is going to bring blessing to the world. Now, Jacob goes to Paddan Aram. He has nothing but his staff. When he leaves, he has 11 sons, at least one daughter, and much wealth. The way, though, that comes about, again, it's not this pristine, faithful kind of life that we see. First of all, you have this stockpiling of sons that Jacob's two wives are involved in. They have different reasons for doing that. Rachel, she just wants the honor of having children. Leah is trying to win her husband's affections. So the two of them, they're very opportunistic and pagan in the way that they approach this, and yet God still blesses them. still shows grace to them. He still blesses them with children. And Jacob, at this same time, he's trying to connive his way into more and more wealth. God doesn't bless his intentions, but he does give him possessions in spite of what Jacob's doing. And so in God's gracious providence, Jacob leaves the land a wealthy, very blessed individual. At this point in the story, that's kind of the center of the story. The rest of Jacob's story has this pattern to it where everything from here on out mirrors something that's already happened in reverse order until we end up back where we began. And so just as we witness Jacob come to Laban, who tricks him with his daughters, as Jacob's leaving with his daughters, he tricks Laban. And then once Jacob's on his way back to the land, just as he was when he was leaving the land, he encounters God. Only there is a key difference here when he encounters God. The first time he encountered God, he wasn't looking for him. And he didn't trust God. He didn't trust God for those promised blessings either. But here he returns and he is desperately trusting in this God to secure these blessings. He's going to meet his brother, Esau. And last he knew, Esau was going to kill him. And so he knows his only hope is God. And so there's a transformation that's occurred in Jacob's life. The self-reliant individual is now desperately relying on God to bless him. And what God does is he commemorates this change that he's brought about in Jacob's life by changing his name, giving him a new name, Israel. So it's with a scene involving Esau that marks Jacob's exit from the promised land, and it's a scene with Esau that marks his entrance back into the promised land. But what Jacob meets when he sees his brother, he sees in his face a work of God. It's the same God who's keeping these promises to Jacob. And Jacob is a changed man too. After stealing his brother's birthright, stealing his birthright and stealing his blessing, he left. And now that he's returning, he is doing anything he can to repay his brother with this blessing that God's given him. And it's a sign of genuine repentance. At the same time, Jacob is still Jacob, and we see that immediately. He's not entirely honest with Esau, and he's still not ready to go to Bethel to fulfill his vow, this vow that he promised when he left. And so he dilly-dallies there in Shechem. And as he does, his daughter Dinah was horribly mistreated by the people of the land. And that, too, is a mirror of what happened at the beginning of that story with Isaac. In both cases, you have a clear example of the way that this indigenous people are dangerous. But you also see that the patriarchs aren't any better. They're doing the same kinds of things. They're being pagans. So what you see is that God's election of the patriarchs and his election of us is not based on our good. It is based entirely on his grace. So then Moses closes out Jacob's story, just as he does with Abraham's. If you compare the ends of both of those stories, a lot of similarities are there. Abraham's story concludes with the death of Sarah. Jacob's story concludes with the death of Rachel. Both endings include the patriarch's son involved in some way with a woman from Paddan Aram. In the first case, Isaac's is normal and good. But Reuben's encounter with Bilhah, Jacob's concubine, is not good. And then it ends with this list of descendants in chapter 35, and same is seen in chapter 25. Both of them end with the death of a patriarch, Abraham in chapter 25 and Isaac in chapter 35. And so with this last scene, Jacob's role fades. Now he's still in the rest of Genesis, but he is no longer as prominent. The rest of the story is going to be hurried along by his sons. And yet we don't turn to Jacob immediately, and we don't turn to his sons immediately. What you see in chapter 36 is just like God did with Ishmael, just as he did in looking at this, the unchosen son, we get this look at the one that God didn't elect, the Esau. So Genesis 36:1 says, "These are the generations of Esau." Only odd thing is, if you look down to verse 9, it repeats that. These are the generations of Esau. It's odd until you look at Genesis. If you pay attention, one of the most obvious things about this book is the way it's carefully organized. Everything is very, very careful, the way that Moses has laid out this story. So you see numerous patterns, and one of the things that you can see, shouldn't be a surprise to us, is that the book of Genesis is divided into how many sections, you think? 12. 12 sections. It's divided by these 11 titles. 11 titles divided into 12 sections. If he didn't include two of these sections here, he'd be one short of that number for completeness and blessing in Genesis. And these two sections here, they do have different purposes. The first one mentions Esau as Edom. That's the name that we saw for Esau in chapter 25. But Israelites associated the name Edom with the country and the name Esau with the person, just like they do with the name Israel. They associate that name Israel with the country, and they associate the name Jacob with the patriarch. So the first section is focused on the person Esau. The second section is focused on the nation that came from him. So in the first section, what we see is Moses focuses on the removal of this obstacle of blessing, or the removal of this obstacle to blessing. And then in the second section, he focuses on the blessing to this rejected person. So just like we saw with Ishmael, we see God's providence as he preserves his covenantal blessing for his elect Jacob. But he also blesses this other person. He promises blessing to him, and he maintains that. So look at how he removes this obstacle in the first section. I've mentioned election a lot here because this is really what the story of the patriarchs tells, and it's what Peter mentioned. But it's not the way some people would portray it. You know, some people would act as though God's choice withholds something from someone that they would have chosen if they could. You know, if it weren't for God saying, just you and not you, then I would have wanted that. But what you see is that's not the way things work. What is God's choice all about? It's all about communion with him. Yes, blessing is a part of that, but it's only blessing in conjunction with union with him, communion with him. So he's choosing a people for himself. He's choosing people where they will be his people and he will be their God. That's the focus of this covenant that he's establishing. And what's true is that Esau never wants communion with God. Not even in the slightest. He might want blessing, but he doesn't want communion with God. How do I know that? Well, in this description in chapter 36, we see a record of the way that he spurned the covenant. He does the very thing that Abraham and Isaac are very careful not to do with their heirs. He says in verse 2, it says, Esau took his wives from the Canaanites. And what's interesting is when that occurs back in chapter 36, it calls them Hittites. Why call them Canaanites here? In order to make it very clear that Esau is rejecting God's purposes and plans, rejecting God's covenant. Esau's destroying the distinction between the people that God has chosen and the people that are going to be punished, that are going to be rejected. He's destroying that distinction. He's connecting his descendants with the Canaanites, and because of that, he cannot inherit the land. And he has to be removed, and he is removed, just like Lot is removed, just like Ishmael is removed, and Abraham's other sons. But once again, God does this through providence. He uses Esau's own free choice to do this. Verse 7 explains Esau's reasoning. It says, "For their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojournings could not support them because of their livestock." That should sound familiar to us because that's the same exact reasoning that makes or provides Lot with his decision to leave the promised land as well, to head to Sodom. So, once again, this is Esau's free choice, And through that free choice, God providentially removes Esau's descendants, the Edomites, from the promised land. So what Esau freely chooses to do, God providentially is doing to preserve his promises. So the first section concludes with mentioning Esau leaving the land of their sojournings. And verse 8 says, so Esau settled in the hill country of Seir. Look over to the first verse of chapter 37, though. If you were at FBI on Wednesday, we talked about how the chapter divisions are not inspired. And this is one of those examples of where Stephen Langton made a mistake. Because this second section doesn't end at the end of chapter 36. It ends with this last verse, which is the first verse of chapter 37. In both places, you see this language of the land of sojournings, as well as mentioning where the person settled. So Esau settled away from the land of sojournings in Seir, and Jacob settled, the same exact Hebrew word. He settled, it says he lived, but it's the same word as settled in the land of sojournings in Canaan. So what does this second section then focus on? That's where we focus on God blessing this rejected son. Even though Esau is rejected by God, and rightfully so, God still chose to bless him. So God's not stingy with his blessing. Verses 9 through 14 illustrate that God blessed Esau with 12 tribes, just as he did with Jacob. It's not as clear if you're just counting up names, but the way that it lists these things out, there are lists of sons and lists of grandsons. And under each of the two lists of grandsons, it ends by saying that they belong to these wives of Esau. They're the sons of these wives. Almost saying that these grandsons are, in essence, sons of Esau. So adding those 9 grandsons to these 3 sons of the third wife, you end up with 12. And that's the number of blessing again. There is one son that's excluded. There's this parenthetical remark there. And Moses explains why in verse 12. It's Amalek. Amalek's the father of this nomadic neighbor of Israel that Israel has constant run-ins with, the Amalekites. And Amalek is the offspring of a concubine. And so he's set apart from the 12 tribes of Edom. That also explains why you have Edomites and then you have Amalekites. Even though they're a part of Edom, they're connected to that. They're their own nation eventually, their own people group. Now, in verses 15 and 19, you have these chiefs, and it does list Amalek there, and it just, again, is talking about this blessing for Esau. Then in verses 20 to 30, Moses turns to the original inhabitants. So verses 20 through 30 are talking about the original inhabitants. It says, these are the sons of Seir, the Horite, the inhabitants of the land. Seir is this patriarch. He's this historical figure who's the father of this area. And it lists these sons who are not his actual sons, but they're significant people in this line of descendants. And they're specifically, in many cases, significant for their connections to Esau. So you have Lotan. His sister is Timnah. Timnah is Eliphaz's concubine. So Lotan's listed as a chief. So Esau's son marries into the leadership of the natives there. And then if you look down to verse 24, see Zebion's son is Anah, and Anah is the father of Esau's wife, Ahalabamah. So he has another child, Dishon. All of them are listed as chiefs. So again, Esau's marrying into this significant family. Esau and his son both marry into leadership in the native or the indigenous peoples there. So it becomes clear how the Edomites are going to take over, just as Deuteronomy 2:12 describes. Then verses 31 through 39 list out kings. And the way it words it connects them with Esau. So Abraham was blessed with this promise that from him would come kings. Jacob gets the same promise in Genesis 35:11. But here in verse 31, the text says that the Edomite kings reigned before any king reigned over the Israelites. God blessed Esau with kingship too, and he did it before he does for Jacob and for his descendants. So the point is that God is not stingy with his blessings. that God blesses Esau, even though Esau does not in any way deserve it. There's nothing about Jacob that deserves his blessing. There's nothing about Esau that deserves this. And yet God blesses him. So what's the difference between Esau's blessing and Jacob's blessing? The difference, again, is that Esau enjoys this blessing separated from God, and Jacob enjoys his blessing in communion with God. And understand that you could be blessed and separated from God, and you might think, well, this is fine, and I can enjoy this. But that is not the kind of blessing that you ultimately want. What you really do want, even though God shows this grace in this way, what you want is to be blessed in communion with God. So how can you enjoy that blessing? It's the same way that we see throughout Genesis. It's by faith. Faith in God, a faith that shows itself in doing what he says. And we also can see the object. When you look at Genesis, when you understand the New Testament and look back on Genesis, you can see the object of our faith throughout Genesis. Jesus is the promised seed of the woman who will crush the serpent's head. Jesus is the descendant of the patriarchs in whom all the families of the earth are blessed. Jesus is the head of the new covenant in whose obedience God's requirement for inheriting blessing are met. And Jesus is the only Son of God, the Son whom he loves, who took the place of every sinner who believes in him. And Jesus paid the penalty for our failure to keep God's covenant requirements. Jesus ensures that we receive these covenant blessings, not on the basis of our obedience, but on the basis of his. And it's through faith in him. So what we see in these final chapters of Genesis that we're going to be focused on now, we see another way that they point to Jesus. We see a suffering servant. Joseph illustrates the suffering servant who provides for God's blessing. And we see God's providence in carrying that out. So Jesus is the only way that you can be a part of the story. Jesus is the only way that this story becomes relevant for you. And you want that. You should want that. So I would encourage you, instead of relying on yourself like people in this book constantly do, stop relying on yourself. Recognize that you need communion with God. You need to be with God. And you need to trust in him. Trust in Jesus. Jesus is the one who endures the punishment from the judge of all the earth. Jesus is the way that you can be connected with Jesus. And then we desperately need to see our lives as part of the story. So this is not fiction. This is not something that we just read about and it's got a moral tale. This is the foundation to our world. When we look at our world, we need to interpret it based on this being our story, our origin story. We want to do that because we can rest in God's promises. We see God keeping his promises, carrying things out. We can trust in that because we know that God's providence is at work now just as much as it was when these pages were written. So Genesis points us to us to trust in God, to know that his providence is at work, to know that his promises will be kept. Join me in prayer. Fathers, we are turning back to this study of Genesis. I pray that you would take your word, that you would use this to put these lenses on our eyes, to see our world this way, to not look at these stories and interpret them with the worldview that people around us are telling us, this naturalistic and materialistic ways of looking at the world. Instead, we would see that you are telling us the truth. In Genesis, you speak the truth. You tell us the way things really are. And that we would take this worldview and that we would apply it to our lives. We would rest in your providence when everything around us is going wrong, when there seem to be obstacles all around, that we would recognize that there's not a single obstacle that you will not bring us through. There's nothing that can stop your promises. Pray that we would be encouraged by this, that we would recognize that the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, you are our God, that we would trust in you. And Father, for anyone who does not have this communion with you by your Son, pray that they would see how truly wonderful it is. That they would know you are a gracious God, a merciful God. Show grace to all these undeserving people, and yet you are a God that we should want to be with. That we should recognize our need for. We pray that everyone here would recognize their need for you. They would stop trying to figure out life on their own. They would repent of that. And they would submit to Jesus as King, and that they would recognize that he is the one who saves them from their sin, saves them from their wandering. We ask all these things through your Son. Amen.